I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The question is out there at the end of inaugural week when the biggest popular street protest in U.S. history greets the new president, Donald Trump, on his second day in office. So where to look now for the people's will, the deep power of this country, the future? And is this the fight now between the White House and the marchers, more than between President, Congress, and the courts, or between Donald Trump and the professional commentariat? Is there a fair fight here, and who knows how it comes out? What we saw on Boston Common last Saturday was far the largest crowd since Pope John Paul II said Mass in the rain in 1979. Overwhelmingly white and middle class, the crowd this time was anxious and buoyant, full of laughs, like their signs, "We shall overcome," about the president. And in a core Democratic state, they were scornful of their party, too. Democrats, one sign said, "You did this to yourselves." Signs came alive when people spoke them to our producer, Mary McGrath.
Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop.
It says, "Good morning, America. This is your wake-up call."
It says, "Build a wall around hate, inequality, greed, violence, ignorance, and intolerance."
Respeta mi existencia o espera mi resistencia. Or respect my existence or expect my resistance.
I have to stand because I am a mother, an educator, a woman, an American, a global citizen, a human, and I cannot accept the hate, the injustice, the ignorance.
It says, "I'm sick of trying to explain your misogyny, bigotry, arrogance to my kids. Sad."
Girls just want to have fundamental rights.
My sign says Muslims against homophobia because I saw one yesterday that said gays against Islamophobia, so I wanted to make this one in response, just for solidarity.
For though I am but small, I am fierce and I am the future.
Our guest, L.A. Kaufman, has been studying protest marches for 35 years and marching in her share of them. She has a strong take on where they're leading in a book of history called Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. L.A. Kaufman, welcome. I'd love a report on what you saw and a sort of report card on a young movement. Where were you on Saturday?
I was down in D.C. for the big women's march there. And your description, anxious and buoyant, I think captures it very well.
You spoke of anger, but not in a key of anger. I mean, your picture.
Well, I think, you know, after Trump's election, there was such a somber mood across the country, particularly on the, you know, the broad side that did not want him to win. And if we're going to be honest, the response was really very subdued. There were some protests, but they were small, and some of them were really tiny. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect. The momentum seemed quite extraordinary, but it was still hard to believe until being in the midst of that incredible crowd on Saturday and looking around. You know, I've been to quite a number of the other contenders for some of the top 10 largest protests in recent decades, and there was a moment in the day when it became very clear this is much bigger than anything I've ever been to before.
What does it take to mobilize 4 million people?
Well, it's interesting because the rules are changing. What it used to take to mobilize 4 million people in the past was a lot of organizational infrastructure. And there were certainly organizations that stepped up to help and played an important role in the marches that unfolded across the country over the weekend. But so much of it was self-organizing, not just on the Internet. Of course, it was happening through social media. But it was also people just coming together, carpooling, having sign-making parties. There was just, really, in a very important sense, a self-organized uprising this past weekend.
Put this in context of what you've written about. The context, basically, since the Civil Rights Movement and Vietnam, so many styles and some of them really important, maybe, you know, starting with ACT UP, but Occupy in 2011, Black Lives Matter most recently. I mean, compare and contrast. Where are we going?
Well, I think first and foremost, when you look back across this history, if you look at the history of protest movements over the last decades, the first lesson is that protest works, that movements that have a protest component, and particularly that have a very strong and emphatic protest component, on the whole are more successful at either protecting gains or winning gains than those that, you know, stick to petitions and lobbying and legislative work, work that's kind of in the standard channels of government. And what's happening now is Donald Trump came into office after what have really been about 6 years of rising organizing work in a number of movements and rising protest movements. You had Occupy in 2011. You had Black Lives Matter in 2014. You've had the Standing Rock protests. And all of these networks of people are part of what made the Women's March happen. It had feminism and the issues of women at the center, but it mobilized this incredible network that was already in place, which is, I think, an important contrast with when Reagan took office. When Reagan took office, which would be, you know, another comparable dramatic shift, movements were kind of had been in crisis and decline for years. And the opposite is true now. So I think the outpouring that we saw on Saturday is a sign that the resistance to come is likely to be much broader and more varied and more resilient than anyone would have dreamed when we woke up after the election day, kind of crushed and fearful of what would happen.
Can I say there's an anomaly here, and it's still raw in my mind, and that is the complete failure of such protest as there was against the war in Iraq. February 15th, 2003, it was a giant phenomenon around the world and in New York, although the context was entirely different. Mayor Bloomberg and the New York City police shut the East Side down for people, thousands and thousands of people who wanted to go to the UN. The New York Times did not report it. The media was virtually silent. But how do we explain that? And are we still reacting to that?
Well, that was a very sobering experience to be part of what at that point was the largest day, is probably still is the largest day of protest in world history, not the largest day of protest in U.S. history, and to have it have seemingly no effect. George Bush shrugged it off, even though the crowds were absolutely staggering and represented really majority public opinion in the U.S.
Yeah, the papers that are talking about Trump's lies today never blinked at anything George Bush said about that war, or Tony Blair either.
Well, indeed. Mass mobilizations in themselves do not tend to create change. So they do many other things. They help build movements, which can then bring change. They connect different movements and weave together relationships among movements that didn't exist. But the model of, you know, you march on Washington and then Congress passes civil rights legislation, that's the exception rather than the rule. Your example, though, of the Iraq War protests, you know, goes farther than that. It's not just simply that they didn't lead to some piece of legislation. They did not stop, you know, an absolute travesty that cost, you know, countless trillions of dollars and who knows how many lives. There is something of this feeling now that we have, which is why I liked your combination, anxious and buoyant, that on the one hand, there something has been awakened that has not been seen, certainly in my lifetime and in years of observing protests, the kind of the many forms of resistance we saw unfolding across this week, you know, each more creative than the next, I think were really inspiring. But the scale of the onslaught of the executive orders and the plans being announced are so enormous that we may be like a row of toothpicks standing in front of, a line of bulldozers.
This is the puzzle, and it's deeply interesting. I mean, I hear your enthusiasm and your confidence in what the Women's March did. At the same time, this undertaking is daunting.
Absolutely.
Washington, the three branches of our government in D.C. are together. The print press covering this president, first of all, it's not as powerful as it was, or as popular. television is still enchanted with the spectacle of Donald Trump. Who knows where the churches are these days? But can you imagine a contest between the power of the presidency and people in the streets? Is this plausible?
I mean, I think it is plausible, and I think, you know, that just to look at some of the ways in which people resisted this week. I mean, on Tuesday, people who have been following the Indivisible Guide, which is a guide that has gotten quite a lot of play, that was written by former congressional staffers and recommends using a Tea Party strategy for the left, went to, you know, the offices of members of Congress all around the country and just kind of barged in large numbers, and, you know, making their bodies present. It wasn't, they weren't doing sit-ins. It wasn't really direct action or civil disobedience, but it was a kind of startling move. On Wednesday, you had climbers from Greenpeace climbing the crane behind the White House, unfurling a banner that says resist, while, you know, Park Service employees are setting up rogue Twitter accounts and tweeting out science facts.
Let's hear it from the Park Service. That's really interesting, and it's the mark of kind of imagination and humor and all those great American qualities. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's all right. I was just going to say that, you know, today GOP congressional leaders were meeting in Philadelphia, and there were large protests there. I mean, I think there is a level of energy that on our side that certainly I found to be pleasantly surprising. I mean, I was there, you know, just a couple days before the inauguration. Donald Trump held his one and only press conference, and there were like two dozen of us standing in a police pen outside Trump Tower. We were the only sign of, you know, friction and dissent on the streets of New York City that morning. So the while I'm not persuaded that we have the collective power to stop what's coming, I do think that in some really crucial way, what happened over this past weekend broke the spell of fear that's been holding people back.
That's important. Ellie Kaufman, stand by. Coming up, what does it mean with the out team in electropolitics dreaming up an organization called the Tea Party of the Left? This is Open Source. White House strategist Steve Bannon declared this week that the news media constitute the opposition in Trump time and that they should keep their mouths shut. So where does that leave the people in the street? 4 million of them modeling a sort of resistance in the Women's March on the day after the inauguration. Our guest, Reverend Mariama White Hammond, was the MC on the stage of the Boston protest. She's a young minister, daughter of ministers in the Bethel AMA Church in Boston, with connections in hip-hop and in green politics, too. You made it look easy, Mariama, juggling a cast of white teachers' union chiefs, black hospital workers, U.S. Senators Warren and Markey, LGBT folk, a score of causes and interest groups on the stage with you. What is the work of alliance making? And by the way, how did a church person get to be in the middle of it?
Well, sometimes I'm a minister, but I'm also an activist. I'm, I've been doing activism for, well, my first boycott was in the seventh grade of Coca-Cola because of its connection to the apartheid government in South Africa. So there's always been a sense of a need for change in my spirit. And so, you know, it's brought me to this place. I know I'm a little, you know, I'm a little strange for a minister, but...
No, you're magic. But how does a minister get into it?
Well, for me, you know, my faith and my activism are not disconnected. You know, my core example is Jesus, and I feel like he was really radical. He was willing to push the envelope. He reached out to the people that everybody else didn't seem to care about. So, you know, I think the church has gotten a little stodgy, a little institutional. We've lost our sense of what we should be. So for me, I think, you know, this is where ministers should be, out on the street and in podiums and... you know, for me, it doesn't seem strange at all. But I know I'm a little bit of an outlier sometimes.
Speak, Mariama, to the observation that it was a very pale crowd on the Common. A lot of black and brown speakers on the stage with you, and they were all well received. But what does that Tell us.
So, you know, I mean, I think that there was some diversity. I mean, I was glad to see when I was out marching, I saw a lot of people I knew who are activists. But I think you're right. I mean, I think we are in a country divided, and we've been divided far too long. And I think this election is actually a real indication of that. We are people that live in enclaves, that people that look like us and think like us, and we don't know enough about how to dialogue across difference. In so many ways. You know, one of the things that's been interesting for me is that since the election, every once in a while I have to take a flight. And when I'm in the airport, I end up in conversations, or I don't know whether I seek them out or they happen to come, with Trump supporters, right? And you'd be surprised how I think there's more that we have in common than you might think. Mm-hmm. I think we share across this country a deep sense that something is wrong. Right? That something needs to shift. I'm a climate activist, too. Something needs to shift. We are not in line for a better future the way that we're living right now. So I agree. Something needs to shift. Okay. Here's where we struggle. We don't all agree on why we're in this place and what we need to do moving forward. And that's where the tension is, that we are divided across class, we're divided across rural and urban, we're divided across, you know, upper middle class and working class. So there's a lot of conversation that we need to have. And, you know, you saw some of that reflected in the march. We still, it was beautiful, it was amazing, and we didn't get as far in the crowd as we'd wanted to with bridging those divides.
Hold it right there for the moment. We spoke earlier today with the historian of Black protest in this moment. Kianga Yamata Taylor teaches at Princeton. She's much admired for her book titled From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Her first thought on the Women's March turnout was that the emerging alliance is going to have to be tougher and sharper than the Democratic Party has come to be.
The behavior of the Democrats since the election demonstrates that that is not an entity that can be relied on to stop Trump. I think thus far, the most poignant example of that is Elizabeth Warren voting to confirm Ben Carson as HUD secretary, or voting so that his confirmation hearing process can move forward. It is an appalling affront to this facade of resistance that she likes to cultivate. I said on social media that Elizabeth Warren is such a typical Democrat. She was raising hell at one of the women's marches on Saturday and doing the devil's work on Tuesday. And so what we're talking about is the need for a true grassroots movement from below that is really independent of the Democratic Party. We must begin the process of building that on a local level, where the impact of Trump's policies will be felt most viscerally. And then we have to create national and even international vehicles by which the different sectors of the movement can communicate with each other, can learn from each other, can generalize their experiences. That really has to be the direction moving forward.
Go back to Black Lives Matter, of which you wrote an important history. How does that keep its shape and character and drive, but also expand inclusively?
The need for Black Lives Matter to expand the field of allies and to be in solidarity with other movements has never been greater, even for the sustainability of the movement itself. Because when a specific target has been placed on anti-police brutality activism, then we can expect the harassment and intimidation, or attempts to do so, to be ramped up against those activists. And so now it's even more urgent to make those common cause alliances with the immigrant rights movement, with the movement against Islamophobia, so with Arab and Muslim organizations. We want to have unity in a broad movement, but on the basis of racial justice, economic justice, we have to fight for those things within what is developing or has the potential to develop into a mass movement.
How many issues can you encompass? I mean, we're talking about Black lives, we're talking about the planet, of course, labor issues, liberal issues, identity issues,
socialist issues, the Bernie agenda?
We can be an anti-Trump resistance that has the same breadth of issues as his contract on America does. Mm-hmm. If you read the document that I believe is now posted on the White House webpage of what the first 100 days of the Trump administration will look like, there's no effort to focus or limit that to a handful of issues. This is a well-coordinated smash-and-grab effort at completely resetting our conceptions of what government should be and essentially handing over the keys in total to corporate America. And so we have to have the same kind of breadth and outlook in combating that, though the specifics of the fight will look different from one city to the next.
What can you take out of the past?
If we can talk about the 1960s, I think that what we saw with the civil rights movement is that simply changing policies and the law is not enough. So even though that was an incredibly historic, heroic struggle, it shortly then gave way to a more insurgent kind of politics in the Black Liberation Movement, or what people referred to also as the Black Power Movement. And to me, what that signals and what really ties all these different issues together is if we get to the root of it, what Angela Davis always says is what it means to be radical, which is to get to the root, then we're talking about an economic system that privileges the tiniest minority at the expense of the vast majority. And it means that what the conclusions that King came to towards the end of his life, which is, why are we paying water bills in a world that is two-thirds made up of water? Who owns the iron ore? Then we're getting to what he described as the need for a radical reconstruction of American society, that as it stands, we live in a country where a parasitic number of people are literally destroying the planet and ordinary people's lives for their own enrichment. And so we are in a moment where we can talk about the need to have more than cosmetic changes, the need for more than this or that shift in public policy, but really we're talking about a radical redistribution of wealth and resources, and really a radically different way of how we envision life in this country. How is it that a 1% can lord so much power and control over the massive 99%? It is the oldest trick in the book, divide and conquer. They use racism, nationalism, gender oppression, religion, homophobia to divide the vast majority of us. That is the way they do it. And they have proven to be very successful at that. But those areas of division can be overcome, I believe, through struggle, through a recognition that they exist, and for the fight to eradicate them.
Kianga Taylor's book, blessed by Cornel West and much talked about, is called From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She wrote a tart farewell to Barack Obama and almost regular commentaries on the Guardian webpage. Mariana White Hammond, do you want to comment?
Sure. I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what she says. I mean, I think that, I can't say what I don't agree with. I mean, I think there is something deeper. And the truth is, I mean, I think what happened in this last election is that white rural folks are feeling the pinch too. But, you know, part of my message to them is the problem isn't black folks in the inner city. There's an economic system that's stacked against all of us, and we need to have a deeper conversation about that. So I really appreciate this sense that we have to fight for the things that we believe in. But I think that what we have to fight for is life first, the right of human beings to live, of the natural environment to survive, because we actually depend on it to live. And you know, one thing that I think is the deep challenge for us is how do we oppose what Trump stands for without a sort of deeply or increasing the divide between those who consider themselves the left and those who voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's the big tension.
Are we ready, L.A. Kaufman, for that kind of radical search of ourselves?
Well, I think I think that there's different time scales happening now, that part of what's happening with the awakening is precisely that kind of deep searching about how did we get here and what really fundamental deep shifts in structures and relationships are going to have to happen to create something fundamentally different. That's the kind of longer vision that Kianga Yamada Taylor's talking about. And then we're in response mode as well. We're kind of in, it's kind of a back and forth where people are talking, do we talk about retaking the Democratic Party? Do we talk about building up local cooperatives? Are we trying to sustain new visions of community, all these kind of long-term visions in tandem with, what are we going to do about the global gag rule now? What are we going to do to defend healthcare? What are we going to do about each of these reactive defensive fights that we're forced to fight? And I think when I look back at the history of movements, what I see as ultimately making the difference is not so much numbers. It's tenacity and it's boldness. It's a willing to stick with it and fight hard, and a willingness of people to step outside their comfort zone and use stronger tactics than perhaps they've been willing to use.
Sounds like ACT UP as a sort of model.
But, absolutely. I mean, ACT UP was never a large group in numbers. I mean, it had in the hundreds or maybe the thousands nationwide, but it didn't have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. And was, there was a zine called Diseased Pariah News. I mean, people with HIV were very much considered pariahs. They were rude. They were very proudly queer. They were very in your face. They were not, they were not building bridges and having dialogues with people who disagreed with them. They were screaming loudly in their faces. And then doing really solid research to figure out how the testing protocols needed to be changed in order to speed up the approval process. I mean, they were working the inside and the outside, but it was, again, that boldness and tenacity that made them save millions of lives.
Got it. I want to make a little turn here. Vanessa Williamson is on the line from Washington. Vanessa, you saw so much of this fury coming 5 years ago when I met you first, and you had just finished writing The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, about the elders of the Rust Belt and elsewhere making much better use of their post-industrial anger than their own lefty kids in the Occupy brigades. And now they're the muscle of the Republican Party. You could say fairly, I think, that they own it. Measure the women's march against what the Tea Party's done.
Well, I think there are really interesting parallels, in particular in the way that some people on the left have been talking about the Tea Party as a model. And I think there's some real value to that in terms of thinking of the Tea Party as a model. And I can talk about some of the reasons I think that they organized in an effective way, right? An effective contemporary way. But I also think that there's a limit there, right? Because the other piece of this to me is not just learning from the right, who at the end of the day also learn from the left about how to do contestatory protest politics. There's also learning from our own left-wing traditions, which I think are, often forgotten. So we're left with, a pretty short list of tactics. But the Tea Party is really valuable as a model in some ways, right? First of all, they were actual grassroots local groups. And I got to tell you, I went into those meetings thinking they were going to be AstroTurf, and they were not. These were actual local people organizing by themselves and with no special billionaire money to help them. But the advantages of being middle-class white retirees. They had time, they had money.
Right, the Coke money was still on its way.
Yeah. Okay. So there was this grassroots power, right? And at the same time, there was a part of the right, the elite right, the sort of Koch brothers right, that looked at their very early protests, which were like, I think, the Women's March, the much infinitesimally smaller. They had a lot of different messages. But there was a part of the right that looked at that and said, this is power. right? And they were willing to work with, you know, a relatively disorganized group of grassroots protesters to make tremendous change in the structure of the Republican Party. So yeah, I think there's real value in thinking about what they achieved and how some of those tactics might apply still for the left.
We won't get through all of this before our break, but we've got to find a name. I want to hear a name, a plausible name for the alliance. And I'm also wondering, where is the money going to come from? I mean, who's got an investment in this sort of resistance?
So I just want to push back because I think there are two models that we're talking about right now. One is to more deeply invest in making one side stronger than it's been up to this point. And I just want to name that I think that there's some level of success that can be found there. But the other question is, can we begin to erase this divide? Because I feel like the Republican and Democratic Party thrive off of this divide that allows them to sort of get into power and then not get into power. But it doesn't move our country forward.
These are all questions we're going to have to answer in the next 20 minutes. Coming up, in addition, WWTS. What might that cranky, vital, indispensable New England voice of Henry David Thoreau have to say to people contemplating civil disobedience? This is Open Source. It's almost 2 years now that nobody, no person, no institution has tangled with Donald Trump and won. Not Orthodox Republicans, not power Democrats, not the print press or the all-powerful networks. So what chance do we give the people on the street protest model that emerged on day two of the Trump term? Back to you, Vanessa Williamson. We've got a lot more to learn from and about the Tea Party, which did not exactly do direct action. What did they do?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think one thing that's important to remember is, like, the value of a demonstration is demonstrating power that exists on days other than the day of your protest, right? That's what a demonstration is supposed to be. And one thing that, you know, Tea Party activists did was stick with it. You know, they didn't just show up on April 15th and complain about tax day. They held local meetings. They ran for local office. They were absolutely willing to go and interrupt their congressmen at meetings. And, you know, I think one of the real sort of tragedies of the Tea Party in an important way is that in so many ways they were doing democracy the way that democracy needs to be practiced, right? But what the outcome has been putting in power someone who is fundamentally at odds with democracy, right? So there's an irony and there's a tragedy, I think, in what we've gotten out of the Tea Party. But yeah, I think there's a lot of value there. You were asking, you know, what do we call this? To me, this is a fight for democracy. And that's a phrase that we can use to talk about the problems of economic inequality that create political inequality, the racial oppression, even the way that we are not stewarding our planet correctly, are all things that to me are about greater political economic equity in terms of power. So I think, you know, I think there's real room for a very broad, a really broad movement to defend, you know, what a lot of, you know, we all hold so dear.
The first strategic choice, which almost went without notice, was that they weren't starting a new party. Despite the Tea Party name, they were taking over a party with all the sort of traditional advantage, habitual voting that comes with it. I mean, that was huge. What if the object of the game, and this is for Mariama too, I mean, is to take over the Democratic Party? I mean, that's what the Tea Party did.
I mean, to me, I think there's real room there. You know, there are local Democratic committees. There are those local meetings. They still operate by the old rules, you know, and you can go there and you can create power. And so, I'm not saying it's the only place, but I see no reason to leave the field on what is one of the ways that we create mass-based power in a democracy.
Ellie Coffin, how does that sound to you? And then where does the...
Yes, I think that's absolutely happening. And I think, you know, our only hope now is to really use all the tools in our toolbox. That's, you know, all the tools of nonviolent resistance and democratic participation. So all the way from, you know, blockades and, you know, disruptive direct action to exactly the kinds of things that Vanessa Williamson's talking about, you know, taking over the Democratic Party from the grassroots. I think some people who were very fired up by the Bernie Sanders campaign are trying to think in smart ways about how to do that now, as are a number of other people. And that's going to be a crucial piece of a larger puzzle.
You can't help thinking in retrospect. I mean, the Bernie Sanders campaign came very, very close to doing what the Tea Party did in the Republican Party, no?
It did, and how different our whole world might look right now if they had succeeded.
Yeah. Mariama, I have to ask, I mean, in retrospect, if Bernie Sanders had had a substantial black vote, mm-hmm. if he could have broken the Clinton lock on black voters in the South and elsewhere, wouldn't he be in the White House eating Lay's potato chips tonight?
So, you know, that's a question we'll never really know. A piece of me wonders, like, you know, Bernie is an unapologetic socialist. Would that have worked for a lot of folks? I think we are not 100% past the Cold War, and I think for some people that just wouldn't work.
But Bernie socialism is beginning to sound like a very mild transition compared to what we've got.
Well, I think the word is transition. I do think, and I agree with L.A. Kaufman, that we need to there's a time for a transition, and the time is now. My concern is I'm not sure that all of America is really clear about that. And I think the challenge that I feel is, yes, we could have another group that mobilizes and wins, right? But I think we're still stuck in a place where we're still a very divided country, where mm-hmm. people have radically different notions of what we're living in and where we need to go. So for me, I think I agree with also with Ms. Coffin, that we really need to step outside of our comfort zone. And for me, I think for folks on the left, for folks that consider themselves liberal, some of that is I think we need to have some deeper dialogue with folks that live in rural areas, with folks that voted for Trump. Mm. I'm not saying that, you know, we all have to get to a point where we sing Kumbaya. But I do think just trying to make one side get to 52%, over the 48%, I get concerned that we push ourselves closer and closer to a situation of civil war because we have two sets of constituencies in this country who have a radically different notion of what we're
without a conversation. Vanessa, I want you to come back to the playbook out of the Tea Party time. Go through it in what detail you can, but then also who's got an investment here? The Tea Party had sort of secret money and then open money and absolutely bottomless money. Is there an equivalent of that on the left in this century?
Yeah, well, first I jump in a little bit about this point about who, you know, sort of broadening the coalition, right? And I think that is such a crucial issue. But it's not just about the folks who voted for Trump and the folks who voted for Clinton. It's about the folks who didn't vote. And that is...
Yep.
A tremendous number of people, and so we've got to be thinking really broadly about what it means to build a country that actually responds to everyone. On the question of the Tea Party, you know, one thing that is sort of heartbreaking in a certain way is sometimes at a local level, occasionally you would see Tea Party groups getting on board with some groups on the left on a very particular local stuff. You know, sometimes it was environmental issues. Actually, was something that was getting people on one page. And I think, you know, you see this more broadly. A lot of the pipeline fights have involved ranchers. You know, who are typically a pretty conservative group of folks. You know, working with Native Americans. So I think that there are places where we can build these alliances, and they're around particular issues that matter to all of us. And there. It's really helpful when you can talk about concrete things, right? When you don't, you know, use jargony terms like identity politics over here or political correctness over there. These are things that just cause trouble and achieve nothing. When, like, we can actually talk about, like, getting to know other Americans better and working together on practical local stuff, and especially at the state level, to make change. Now, the heartbreaking part of this is you would sometimes see this kind of broad-based coalitions happening, including even some local tea parties, but it so often broke, especially when things became nationalized. Mm. And so often on questions of immigration, you know, there was on the one hand this, you know, deep democratic spirit of, you know, we're going to go to the meetings and we're going to do the work. But there was also this just, you know, so sad demonization of people who were different from them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's ethnic minorities, that's immigrants, that's young people. We're all seen as, you know, a terribly dangerous un-American other. And that kind of thinking about other people is truly dangerous in a democracy.
Hmm. Vanessa, I totally agree. I mean, I think what you're saying is, you know, the politics of race, the politics of ethnicity, they're nothing new in this country, and they've mm-hmm. prevented people from having the conversations. But I think what you're naming is that if some of us really got around the table, those of us who are normal people, don't have $1 million, don't have, a bunch of folks behind us, if we named what we really believe in and what we want, I think we would be surprised that there's a lot in common. But then when you get the parties, the, you know, sort of groups who are interested in keeping us on one side or another, right, who benefit from that division, we don't have those conversations. So one of the things I've been saying to a lot of my friends is, particularly a lot of my white friends, you need to go home and talk to your folks. Tell them where you're invite me. I'll come. Because we need to start having these conversations. This division is going to prevent us from ever getting to the kind of country that I want to live in. I didn't always realize that. I used to think I could just, entrench myself in leftist politics. But I'm realizing if I really want to live in a country where we take care of each other, then all has to mean all. And that even means some folks that I don't hang out with a lot. But I'm willing to start hanging out with them if that's what's needed in order to get us to a new kind of society.
Interesting. Mariama, you're kind of magic, and it's in your presence. I mean, stick with it.
Well, I mean, I think the reality is climate change is real. As I mentioned, I'm a climate activist. We are on a countdown to a way of living that's unlike what we've ever seen before. And either we're going to come up with a solution now, or we're going to be drowning together. And I don't want to drown together, so I don't know what other option I have than to figure out a new way forward.
Henry David Thoreau keeps coming to mind in his 200th birthday year, the radical anarchist from Concord, Massachusetts, who said no to government in slavery time, and in 1849 wrote the everlasting manual for dissidents in his essay, Civil Disobedience. Thoreau comes up pointedly in this week when President Trump says he will root out undocumented immigrants in what have been declared sanctuary cities in states like New York, Massachusetts, and California. In one of his fiercest essays called Slavery in Massachusetts from 1856, Thoreau was responding to the news that under the Fugitive Slave Act, a black slave preacher named Anthony Burns had been captured in Boston, and despite a near riot of street protest against federal troops and U.S. Marshals, Burns was returned to bondage in Virginia. "I have lived for the last month," Thoreau finally wrote, "with the sense of having suffered a vast and indefinite loss. At last it occurred to me that what I had lost was a country." It's not a precise parallel here, except in the feeling that an essential piece of this country is at risk again. So I asked the young Thoreauvian, Mark Greif, to remind us of the author of so much American gospel, that very odd stick from Concord. Mark Greif is a writer and founding editor of the website N+1. He has collected his own essays under a title that is straight out of Thoreau. He called his book Against Everything.
Thoreau's a funny character, and I've found myself thinking constantly in the last few days, what would he make of Trump? What would he make of this government? What would he make of millions of people in the streets at the Women's March? The contention that Thoreau kind of has, the claim he makes over and over again, is always to start with the individual first. Start with yourself.
Yes.
And it seems very clear to me, reading from Civil Disobedience and Walden, that a Thoreauvian vision of Trump, first of all, is to see him as a great time waster, a kind of new time waster in chief, someone who will engross our attention and keep us from living our regular lives, noticing our neighbors, noticing what's right in front of our nose. It's funny to imagine him now because, on the one hand, I think he would insist, you must not let this fool, this comedian, this menace take over your ordinary lives, do what you would do. And at the same time, it seems clear that he would insist, you can't live just an ordinary life, but have to manifest yourself in some way by conscience in opposition.
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful line and the challenge in that Civil Disobedience essay is that the individual of moral conviction and action is already a majority of one. That's what you got to cultivate. And that's what will change history. I'm trying to think of people who were a majority of one. Martin Luther King was a majority of one. Nelson Mandela was a majority of one. Muhammad Ali strikes me as an extraordinary case, too. Broke the law, was denied his greatest achievement, went into exile and came back triumphant and remained himself.
Yeah, certainly there is this history of, you know, the great American figures, especially black figures who are, because they speak out, speak the truth, pushed away. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson losing his passport and so forth. At the same time, I mean, I worry for myself. I'm not a particularly heroic or courageous person, although often indignant or outraged. And for the rest of us, the not quite heroes, to think about what it would mean to withdraw assent to things that you don't believe in. It's a tough task, one that I guess is kind of back on the agenda now.
Throwing away was against everything except arrowheads and fishes and the woods. But he left a mark, and he's 200 years old this year. So the moral is read Thoreau and feel free to be a crank in the age of Trump.
Be a crank indeed. I sometimes think, you know, what would Thoreau do, WWTD, in these times? Because he presents you with these immediate puzzles about things we get used to, right? The laws are there. They represent us all, etc. He says, well, does it really represent you? What would it take to ask if this represented you?
Right after the election, Mark, you wrote that we don't have a president. No president was the motto. Sounds like Thoreau's motto of better than small government would be no government. Where do you go with that slogan?
I was trying to think what was good in a moment of really realizing the worst, having the worst president. And I was trying to think, too, why I felt uneasy with the slogan that you heard from people, not my president. Because it always worries me a bit when you think you can simply opt out of responsibility for, you know, a state that relies on the collective consent of the governed. I think with this vision of no president as something other than a slogan, what I imagine really is that it might well be time, you know, in a country that vowed it would not have kings or queens and would not have single leaders, to find a way out of always thinking of ourselves, endlessly fantasizing, in relation to single individuals, presidents or possible presidents. During the election, I did find myself thinking this was crazy to spend so much time thinking, am I more like Hillary? Am I more like Donald? Do I like Hillary? Do I like Donald? Who cares? Why even use these single names or single people as kind of exemplars of who we might be as a nation? Not just as a thought experiment, I do feel kind of in earnest. Actually, it might be good to think about what a United States would be like if we could get rid of presidents altogether. And certainly Trump presents a real case of it, because I do think his election is illegitimate in many ways. And as a political personality, he seems illegitimate to be a leader precisely because of his life and lies and all the rest. Something very unfamiliar to us now about Thoreau is that he really did think of himself, rightly, as being very close to the founding, right? So it's, let's say, 75 years earlier when he's writing his major works, and there he was in Concord and Lexington, and he thought, oh, these people who started a new country and founded the nation, well, that's my grandparents' generation. But for that reason, he had this odd idea that every person or every American might think of him or herself as, again, being a kind of founding generation. And Thoreau would put to us the question, all these hundreds of years later, have we really achieved independence in the way that we promised ourselves with this government? And if not, what would it take?
One last line from Thoreau. He wrote, this government never furthered any enterprise. It does not keep the country free. It does not settle the West. It does not educate. The character inherent in the American people has done all that has been accomplished, and it would have done somewhat more if the government had not sometimes got in the way. Meaning, in effect, it's still up to us, and we're going to see again what we're made of. Thank you, Henry David Thoreau, and thank you, Mark Greif. Thank you, Mariama White-Hammond, L.A. Kaufman, Vanessa Williamson, and Kianga Yamata Taylor. If you're in Boston on February 4th, the wise comic Jimmy Tingle will be doing his Humor for Humanity show at Sanders Theater. Use the code OPENSOURCE when you buy your ticket, and you'll be helping our cause too. Our show this week was produced by our own mob, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our standard bearer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.